It's that time of the year when there's a lot of talk about the last 12 months, the various lists of the best TV shows, the best books, the best movies. Tonight we're taking a look at the financial highs and lows of 2014 with the fund manager and investment advisor, Roger Montgomery, and the author of Valuabled. Before we start looking back, let's talk about some of the issues that are happening at the moment, as we speak. In fact, it was a pretty rocky day on the Australian share market today, Rog.
Yeah, it was. I'm not surprised, and yeah. I'm quite delighted that we've had a lot of cash in anticipation of this. We've been talking
about...
Rene
Rifkin used to always say, buy in gloom, sell in boom.
Well, it makes a lot of sense, you know, and buying straw hats in winter and all of those, I think it was... I think it was a Rothschild or it was one of the big oil barons, it might have been, who said, buy when everybody is selling and hold until everybody is buying. And right now, at the moment, if you look at property and if you look at shares, most people have been buyers. They haven't been sellers. So we've, in anticipation of a rocky road in resources and materials, so iron ore and coal, which you alluded to in your introduction,
yep.
We've anticipated that that would have a material impact on our economy. It would have a material impact on the industry that services that industry. And when you looked at what was left, well, there wasn't a lot of optimism to be had there. And so in anticipation of that, we must have raised something like 30% or 35% cash. And that means that at the moment, we're not suffering as much as others might be in their sell-off.
Incidentally, if you'd like to SMS, feel free, 0467 922 702. 0467 922 702. The weaker Australian dollar hit a 4.5-year low today, dropped below 83 US cents, and the Reserve Bank keeps telling us it must be lower. What's your take?
We knew China was slowing down 2 years ago, and right now they're talking about 7% growth. Can I assure everybody that China is not growing at 7%? It's growing significantly slower than that, and the official numbers will continue to come down. I'll give you an example why I think it's slowing. It's the way the numbers are recorded. Now, the first thing that you have to question is, how is it possible that China can release numbers for the end of the month on the entire nation's growth faster than the United States can after the end of the month, when they've got such a disparate country and such a disparate economy? It's almost impossible to believe that they could collate those numbers and get those numbers in by the end of the month. Having said that, the way they calculate, for example, retail sales. Here in Australia, retail sales is calculated on the value of the products that are sold to consumers. In China, it's calculated based on when the product leaves the factory, not when it's actually bought. So what can be happening is the products can be produced out of the factory and they can be lifting inventory in another warehouse somewhere and no one's buying it. Eventually it will catch up. Eventually that number will reflect the state of consumption in China, but it's only when the feedback loop has got to the point where the factories start producing less that you'll see that number officially slow down. The real economic growth rate of China is slower than what's being officially reported. It'll slow further. That'll have significant implications for the prices of our commodities. Therefore, it'll have significant implications on people's perceptions of where the Australian dollar should be, particularly institutional and international investors, and they will continue to sell the Australian dollar. Now, it's been also 2 years that we've been told by the Reserve Bank of Australia that the dollar should be lower. It isn't as justified where it was, up at $1, $2 and $5. It shouldn't have been there because
that was partly the weakness in the US, wasn't it?
Correct. It was, yeah. And what was called the carry trade. We had relatively high interest rates, so it made a lot of sense to borrow money in the United States and invest it in anything in Australia at a higher rate of return. And that carry trade, that flow of funds from overseas into Australia to take advantage of our relatively higher interest rates, meant that that supported the Australian dollar. But that carry trade is now unwinding, and so we're seeing the Australian dollar come off. And it could come off a long way. If you think about iron ore, everyone's seeing it at $60 or $70 or whatever it was, whatever it is now. And remember, it wasn't that long ago that it was $100. For 30 years prior to 2004, three decades prior to 2004, the iron ore price traded between $10 and $20 a tonne. And it was only between 2004 and 2011 that everyone looked at the construction boom that was going on in China and anticipated how much steel would be required that drove the commodity higher, and it went to $187 a ton. And I can remember being on TV with Tiki Fullerton on The Business, and it was the CFO, I think, of the CFO of Fortescue Metals, who was saying that they believe the long term natural level for the iron ore price was somewhere around $100 a ton or $110 a ton. Mm. And Tiki turned to me and she said, what do you think about that, Roger? And I said, well, never ask a barber whether you need a haircut, because the reality is they're always going to talk it up. But supply is increasing in Australia, even at these low prices. Vale has indicated their new mine is going to come online. They're going to produce vastly more iron ore. Rio has said the same thing. BHP
Gina
has said
Reinhardt's
the same thing.
Gina Reinhart's mine is about to come on board.
Gina Reinhart, even at these lower prices, they're going to produce more. That's not going to stop the price from falling. That's going to influence the price to go down, particularly if China is actually slowing. So you could expect to see significantly lower iron ore prices. And when you look at the correlation of investment in resources, in the resource sector, and the correlation between that and the Australian dollar, then there's only one way for the Australian dollar to go, and I believe it's going to go lower. And I have my own personal money backing that particular trade. So yeah. In my own term deposits, where I have cash, it is not in Australian dollars, and it hasn't been since $1.02 against the US. It's sitting in British pounds, Singapore dollars, and US dollars.
Interesting. It's a little bit hard to know exactly what's happening with interest rates at the moment. They have been on hold officially for a year, as far as the Reserve Bank is concerned. Now, there have been, I think, two or three of the majors saying, well, the next move could be down again, which, honestly, if you'd said it a month ago, most people would have had you certified.
Yes.
But it's now looking as a possibility. The only problem that they've had, I guess, has been the mini boom that has been happening in the property sector.
Yeah, that's the only thing I believe that has stopped the Reserve Bank of Australia from cutting rates already. We've had the longest run of no interest rate change. I think it's been 16 months or 17 months now with no interest rate change. And I think that's a quasi-rate cut.
I honestly felt that it was going to definitely be up is the next move.
Yeah.
But, you know, I under no circumstances thought that we would see an interest rate reduction from where we are at the moment.
Well, I think we have what's called an income recession in Australia already. And if it wasn't for the property boom slash bubble, quote unquote, if it wasn't because of that, we would actually have seen rate cuts already. You've got to remember there's a large number of people, particularly in the mining services space, who are going to lose their jobs, unfortunately, and that's because of the amount of investment in mining is plunging. And so where are those people going to go? There's not a lot of other industries that the government has incentivized over the last 15 years to absorb those tens of thousands of people that are likely to lose their jobs.
It's going to be an awkward one, isn't it? APRA apparently is about to clamp down on lending to property investors. There's a story in the Financial Review in the morning saying that APRA intends to certainly try and keep a hold on the level of investor money that's been given by the majors. I think you were suggesting that in the 3 months to September, it was as high as 10% to investors.
10% growth to new investors, and that is a record number, or very close to it, if it isn't a record.
Well, according to this, credit growth to investors hit 9.9% in October. So
there you go. So it's still right up there.
Yeah.
So look, there's no doubt. There's no doubt that we've got a generation of people, Tony, who have unfortunately realised too late that they don't have enough money to retire on. And the result of that, combined with very, very low interest rates on cash term deposits of, Tony, it used to be that if you worked your entire life and you saved $1 million, you had it made. You're a millionaire. That was a very large amount of money. Now, if you put $1 million into a term deposit, you might earn 3.2% annually, and that's equivalent to $32,000. Now, the poverty line in Australia for a couple with two children is $39,000. So if you've got $1 million in the bank and that's all you've got and you're earning interest, you're arguably impoverished. You're arguably below the poverty line in terms of your income. Now, a
mind you, you wouldn't be having the kids at that stage. No, well, yeah, probably, I hope you've got the kids at that stage.
Well, you never know, yeah. That's right. We don't want to get into people's private lives. But the reality is that those economics, those numbers, are forcing people to take more risk than they normally would. So they have, by low interest rates, if you like, have corrupted people's sense of risk. And this is a long-winded answer to your question.
Yep.
They're being forced into other assets. Shares and property are classic examples. Now, the other thing is, because of the global financial crisis, which was only a few short years ago, six or seven years ago, people pulled money out of the stock market at the bottom of that. They didn't want to lose anymore. They couldn't bear it anymore. Yeah. So there's an inordinate amount of money.
Whereas if you'd actually waited about 18 months, you probably would have gotten a margin of it back. Yeah.
But what it means is that there's a disproportionate amount of baby boomers' wealth sitting in cash, earning those poor returns, which is another kick in the guts and another kick in the bum to actually go and invest somewhere else. So while interest rates remain low, you're going to continue to see this forced investment in other assets such as shares and property. The problem is, though, that your returns are not dependent, or your returns aren't determined by how cheap it is to borrow money. Your returns are determined by the price you pay for the asset. The higher the price you pay for that asset, the lower your return. And right now, based on incomes, people are paying a very high price for property.
Roger, I know you're also a little bit concerned about the level of overseas interest in Australia, and not particularly just the big city real estate, but also regional real estate.
Yeah, we've got a very large problem, and I don't want to be too controversial, but I do believe the government's current policy settings are putting us on the road to serfdom. And what I mean by that is, at the moment, we can't afford our imports from the revenue that we're earning on our exports. And so that creates what's called a balance of payments current account deficit. So simply put, our exports aren't earning enough to pay for our imports. We're living beyond our means. It takes about 7 tons of iron ore to buy one iPhone. And therefore, we need what's called a capital account surplus. So we need to import money from overseas to pay for that gap. Now, that gap, if Tony, you came to me and I was a bank and you said, I'm spending $5 million a month and I'm earning $3 million a month, I would say to you, well, we have a problem. And that's Australia's
position.
And I'd agree
with him.
And you'd agree. You'd say, we have a problem. Now, that's what we're doing every single month on a national level. Now, how do we pay for that? We have a capital account surplus, so the money has to be imported. There's two ways to do that. One way is to issue bonds and sell those bonds. That's called borrowing money. And party government ideology doesn't like debt, so we can't have that. The alternative is we sell assets. So we can sell businesses, we can sell farms, we can sell property, we can do all those things. And that's precisely what's happening. Now, this is being pitched to us as Australia being open for business, hence the free trade agreement. Now, give me a break on the free trade agreement, because that free trade agreement, which is supposed to be worth, with China, supposed to be worth $18 billion over 10 years, divide that by 10, that's $1.8 billion per annum. By the way, all the benefits of that free trade agreement are completely wiped out by a $2 decline in the price of iron ore, right? So it's not a big deal. Nevertheless, what are we giving away for that free trade agreement? Well, one of the things that's being talked about now by Andrew Robb is the idea. Now, remember, if we've sold a farm to an overseas investor, they own that farm, we can work for them. So we can have our own labour, and it's also pitched that they'll bring new technology and they'll expand the processing and all of those great things. Here's the problem, though. China, in their free trade negotiations, have asked to import their own labour. into the businesses and the properties that they own. Yep. So not only are we renters of the property,
we're not getting the jobs.
We're not even getting the jobs. And where it's happened elsewhere in the world, in Angola, in Africa, in Latin America, in Myanmar, it hasn't worked out that well for the locals. So I've got a big concern that the policy settings that the government currently has aren't really set for the long term. They're not set for our kids. Despite Tony Abbott's protestations that we don't want to leave our children with a great deal of debt, I agree with that. Mm-hmm. But we're not leaving them with any assets which we can borrow for future investment, and we're not leaving them with any assets that earn an income to help pay off the debt. So that's a big problem for me.
I mean, when you look at assets that could be sold, I mean, we put Medibank Private on the block just a couple of months ago, and that's gone through, which I'm sure the money gratefully received. But you look around Australia Post, the Australian Defence Housing, they're seen as potential. But, I mean, that's the last of the silverware, I would have thought.
Well, that's certainly one way to look at it. And, in fact, if there's nothing left to sell, you know, I'd argue that's a problem because, again, it comes back to the point I made earlier that clearly the government's successive governments over decades have seen the demise of the car manufacturing industry in Australia coming. But what have they actually done to incentivise new industries to absorb these people who are losing their jobs in the antiquated industries that we're no longer competitive in? It seems to me, Tony, and I don't want to get on the soapbox too passionately, but it strikes me that we have one policy setting that the ACCC enforces, and that is lower prices for consumers is good, and another policy that says we must continue to pay people a lot. Now, businesses are stuck in the middle. If you're forcing businesses to earn less because their products have to be cheaper in order to compete with cheap overseas imports, but we still have policy settings that ensure people are getting paid time and a half or triple time or quadruple time or whatever it is, plus long service leave and all those other things, then our businesses go out of business. And if our businesses go out of business, who's going to employ us? We have to work for foreign landlords again because they own our businesses and they own our properties. And the problem that I've got with that is if they bring in their foreign labour, then we won't even have the jobs. And this is the path of serfdom that I've been talking about. And I am very, very concerned about it because as an investor, as a professional investor in the stock market, I'm worried that we've got a group of businesses that are becoming less and less competitive and less attractive to invest in.
Looking ahead, 2015, how do you see the stock market? I mean, we saw a substantial rock today. It was, I think, down about 1.7% on the trade day. How do you see it going forward?
Well, I'm never accurate predicting these things. So if you said to me, where will it be on October the 7th next year? I've absolutely no idea. What I can tell you with confidence is that the stock market currently is about 7 or 8% overvalued. So it's 7 or 8% more expensive than what we think it's actually worth. Now, that doesn't mean that it's going to crash. In fact, before the GFC, the stock market went from being about 1% overvalued to about 23% or 24% overvalued, and it was overvalued for about 3 years. So the stock market can remain overvalued for quite some time. All it suggests to me is there's not a lot of value around, and while 3.2% in cash doesn't seem very attractive, it's a darn sight better than minus 15%, which is a possibility if the stock market goes down. Now, I was concerned 6 months ago about inflation. I was concerned 6 months ago that the United States Federal Reserve and Janet Yellen were saying that, watch out everyone, the markets are going to become increasingly volatile as we start to turn interest rates back up. But the US economy isn't growing very strongly. The Australian economy certainly isn't. The European economy, neither is Japan. China's now slowing down dramatically. There's a very real risk, not of inflation, but of deflation. And why is that a problem? Well, if you believe products and assets are going to go up, you don't delay your purchase of those things. You buy them now because they're going to be more expensive in the future. But my friends who lived in Japan for a long time told me that their experience living in a deflation environment was the exact opposite. people stopped buying because they knew the things would be cheaper in a month's time, 6 months' time, and a year's time. So they continually deferred their purchases. That means businesses go broke. It's a real problem. So I think as soon as these macroprudential levers come into place and APRA starts working on the banks to slow down lending on housing, if the RBA sees that being effective, they'll start to cut rates. And if they cut rates, that could be stimulus for our economy. However, let me say this. I think it really is a pebble in a very large pond in terms of the effect it's going to have, because the overwhelming influence, you know, as a nation that is dominated by agriculture and resources, we're seeing slowing demand for those things. And that's a really, that's the overwhelming problem for Australia. I really see us slowing down dramatically. And if we do slow down dramatically, then that's going to cause all sorts of problems for our businesses and, again, for our investment returns long term. Mm.
So you feel that the government needs to perhaps think seriously about a stimulus within the next little while?
Well, you know, Tony, if you haven't borrowed, if you haven't borrowed money at 4%,
yeah,
I mean, at 3.75, is it going to make a dramatic difference to you about whether you're going to borrow or not? Probably not. You know, if the money, if my credit card goes from 18% to 16%, am I going to jump out to JB Hi-Fi or wherever and go and buy all these things? Probably not. It's not going to make much difference to me. All I care about is whether or not I'm going to keep my job. And that's going to determine whether I borrow money or not. And if I've just borrowed over the top for a house, I need to pay that off before I get really excited about borrowing any more money for anything else. So I think this excessive exuberance that we've experienced in housing could actually prevent people from consuming and borrowing money to buy consumption goods, and that's going to slow out, again, our retail sector.
You ought to say that at least, you know, if you're buying a house or buying an investment property, at least it's some form of enforced savings. So that's probably good for the economy.
Yeah, and you'll feel good about it provided the price of the property doesn't go below the amount you've borrowed. But if it goes below the amount you've borrowed and you've got negative equity, then you're not going to feel too good about being forced to save. And that's going to have, again, a dramatic negative wealth effect. Now, I'm painting a pretty bleak picture here, Tony. I appreciate that. In all of that, there are businesses in Australia that are expanding offshore and doing remarkably well. There's one business I can think of. Again, this is not a recommendation. People need to go and seek their own personal professional advice. But there's a business that we own shares in called Infomedia. Now, why do we like this business and what does it do? This is a very small business. What it does, it actually produces software. They're out at French's Forest there, and what they do is they make software for car service centres, mechanics. And what the software does is it links the mechanic up with the original equipment manufacturer so that they can order their parts. They can identify the problem with the car. They can immediately look at what part number that is. They can then order that part all at the touch of a button. Now, this particular company has about 14,000 users in Australia, 14,000 individual users that are buying these modules that only cost $50 a month. But in the United States, they're starting to expand. And I met the lady who's actually front and center in the sales drive over in the United States. Now, in Australia, a big mechanics center, say Toyota dealership or one of those dealerships, their service center might have 10 hoists. And they've got 14,000 users in Australia, this particular company, Infomedia. In the United States, they've got two trials or three trials going on at the moment, and each of those trials is for a group that might have a couple of hundred dealerships, and some of those dealerships have 100 hoists. You know, the Los Angeles Toyota dealership has something like 100 hoists, 10 times bigger than some of our biggest in Australia. If they take, the company came out, Infomedia came out at their annual general meeting and said, we can't forecast next year's earnings because we don't know how big it's going to be. So I tell you that story because there are companies listed in Australia that are doing remarkably well and growing despite the relatively bleak picture that I've painted.
Yes, I mean, I was only seeing a financial company the other day that recently listed, which has had a very solid year dealing in foreign currency. So, you know, there's one of those things where, you know...
Well, you think about that business, and I think I know the one you're talking about, Tony, and, you know, that's another way people can save a lot of money. I looked at transferring some money overseas with my bank, and they wanted to charge me almost 4% of the amount. So we were talking about $100,000. They wanted to charge me $4,000 in spread, in the spread between, in the cross rate, and also in their fees. I used an online transfer, and now our company only transfers money overseas through this online transfer company, this foreign exchange company, and it was a couple hundred dollars. You know, I saved $3,800 on that particular transfer, and that's a business that's listed, it's growing, and going very well. So there are these opportunities to invest, but the missing link, remember what I said earlier about property, the higher the price you pay, the lower your return. So you want to buy these great businesses at a low price. So I'm delighted that the stock market's down 1.7%. As a net buyer of assets, I know I'm going to be buying things over the next month, 2 months and 6 months. I actually want prices to go down, not up. I want the stock market to crash ideally so that I can buy more of these wonderful businesses at cheaper prices.
Yes. However, if you're in the pool and the water's running out, it's not comforting. Roger Montgomery is with us tonight, and we are talking about 2014 and what's likely to happen in 2015. As you've heard, Roger does have an opinion on a lot of issues relating to the market. He is a fund manager and investment advisor. If you'd like to join us, perhaps you would like to ask a question, maybe you'd like to make a statement on what's been said already. If you'd like to join the conversation, love to hear from you.
Lines are now open. Call 1-300-800-222.
The Nightlife 105.7 ABC Darwin Territory Radio. Darwin's weather, showers and storms likely, 27 to 33. In Alice, a hot possible storm and 25 to 41. We're taking calls for the challenge. 1-300-800-222. 1-300-800-222 to win Driving Home for Christmas, the Lee Kernaghan CD. Plus, from Sesame Street, Elmo, the musical. Great fun for the kids. 1-300-800-222. Come along, join that challenge.
Across Australia, you're with Tony Delroy on Nightlife. It's Nightlife.
Moving around to 16 minutes to the latest ABC News. With me in studio tonight is Roger Montgomery, from Montgomery Investment Management, fund manager and investment advisor. And we have to warn you, generally, we can't give specific advice on particular shares that you have to research yourself and do your best. John, you want to ask about Challenger Financial.
Yeah, hi, Tony and Roger. Roger, I know you've liked Challenger previously. Obviously, it had a bit of an air pocket with Social Security ruling with one of their annuity products. I'm just wondering, has anything sort of changed there for you in terms of, I know the price has come down a fair bit, in terms of your long-term view of where the company can go?
And thanks for the question. No, nothing's changed for us. I sat down with Jeremy Cooper of the Cooper Review, who's chair of the annuity products for Challenger, and asked him that question. It was a complete backflip by the Department of Social Services. That it's a very complicated product and very difficult to structure that particular product, and they received all sorts of rulings from the Department of Social Services.
This is relating to annuities.
Annuity product, quite a specific annuity product, and only a small part of their business. So that particular business is now being, is now, I guess, mothballed until they find out what's going to be the final decision of the Department of Social Security. The larger story, the longer term story for the business, it remains very, very good, and that is that more and more people are going to be attracted to these annuity-style products, which gives them some security of income over the long run. The one risk, of course, is that the business remains beholden to legislative risk, and there's always the possibility that legislation can change. Assuming the status quo, then the business, we believe, is worth substantially more than where it's trading today. Having said that, though, we have already bought. We've made a profit, an unrealised profit, even at these lower prices. We're not tempted to add to our positions just yet. We'd like to get see them even cheaper if we can.
Okay, thank you.
All right, John, thanks for that. Stephen, you are wondering how the Trade Minister, Andrew Robb, doesn't see the long term.
Yeah, well, exactly, Tony. I must congratulate Roger on his rundown on the pessimistic view of where this country's heading. I've been campaigning and battling my head against the brick wall for 30 years over this, and I've got no formal economic training, but... You know, how come people like Andrew Robb and the other free traders can't see that these so-called free trade agreements only seek to destroy our own industry?
Let's take a step back from that. That's an excellent question. If you and I were recruiting 19 cabinet seats to run this country, and we asked for all their CVs, I guarantee we wouldn't choose a team of people where the vast bulk of them were career politicians or career lawyers. When I say the vast bulk, I mean 17 of 19 of them are career politicians and career lawyers. We would ask for people with a variety of experience, particularly in the commercial fields, and that would lead us, I think, to better results. Unfortunately, we've got many, many things working against us recruiting the right people for the right jobs. But the people leading us at the moment, I think, are underqualified for the job that's at hand. And that includes Andrew Robb, who I believe, he told me, can I tell you, I had a breakfast with Andrew Robb. It was a breakfast dinner with a broker. Mm. And there were a number of business leaders at that particular meeting. And before the LNP were elected, he said to me that we're going to play to our strengths, which are resources and agriculture. Now, let me tell you why I think that's an ignorant thing to say. The best businesses to own and the best businesses to encourage are businesses with competitive advantages, businesses that can retain money and generate very high rates of return on that retained money. Now, the most valuable competitive advantage of all is the ability to charge more for your product. And people still cross the road and buy your product, even though it's sold everywhere else. They buy yours because it's the best, it has the greatest reputation, and works the best, and so on. So you can charge more every year for that product, and people will still knock your door down to buy your particular product. That's the best business to own. The worst business to own is the one that must by necessity do the opposite, take large amounts of capital and reinvest it at low rates of return. That's precisely what resource businesses and agricultural businesses have to do, because they don't have that competitive advantage, the ability to charge more for their products. They're price takers. Whatever the global price is for iron ore, we have to take it. Whatever the global price is for beef or lamb or whatever it is, we have to take it. They're not our strengths, Mr. Robb. They're a weakness. We might have geographic proximity to China, and that could be a good thing, but that's all we've got. What the government has failed to do is incentivize industries that add value to our exports. I can remember at university years ago, Professor Ian Harper telling me it's absurd that we ship chips, wood chips, to Japan, they make paper, and then we buy the paper back. You know, it's absurd. Now, what I'm constantly told is, Roger, we can't afford to manufacture that stuff in Australia. Why? Because our salaries are too high. Why are our salaries too high? Well, that's history, but they are. And unfortunately, we've done nothing about incentivising the things that we're good at. So what I proposed is, one idea is, we have a tax holiday for startups. Singapore has it. If I started a business in Singapore today, my first $200,000 would be tax-free. My next $100,000 would be taxed at 50% of the going rate, which is about 7%. And because it's a financial services business, if I was going over there, I'd play to my strengths, which is financial services, I'd get a tax holiday completely. My first $300,000 would be tax-free for the first 3 years. Now, why can't we do that in Australia? I have no idea, but there doesn't seem to be any inclination or any incentive. Everyone's focused on playing to our strengths, resources and agriculture. It's a huge problem.
Yeah, thanks, Stephen, for the call. Joe, you're wondering about the current situation about the price of gold, which is lingering with intent around $1,200 an ounce at the moment.
Yeah, just wondering opinions on gold and what would need to happen in the world for that gold price to spike.
Well, let me give you an opinion on gold, but it might not be the opinion that you actually want. or would like to hear. If we melded together all the gold in the world and it formed a cube, it would be 68 metres cubed. That would be it. It would fit roughly inside the infield of a baseball field. And it would be worth, at current prices, I think it would be worth about, I think it's about $6 trillion. Roughly $6 trillion. $4.5 to $6 trillion. That would be it. Now, in 100 years' time, what can you do with that cube of gold? Warren Buffett said you could look at it and you could fondle it, but that's all it does. And in 100 years' time, that's all you could do with it even then. Now, if you're buying gold, what I'm trying to say is if you're buying gold, you're simply speculating that somebody else down the track will pay more for it, because it doesn't actually do anything. It doesn't serve any industrial purpose. It doesn't produce any income. So it's pure speculation. But with that $4.5 to $6 trillion, you could buy all the real estate in Manhattan. You could buy pretty much all of the arable producing cropland in the United States, and you'd earn mountains of income over many, many years, and over 100 years, you would earn vastly more than you're earning today. One is an investment, one is pure speculation. So I don't know where the gold price is going to go, but I do know that you're not investing in gold if you buy gold.
Okay, let's put that to one side and have a look at the crystal ball and oil prices. Jamie, you're interested.
Yeah, I am. I'm interested in your thoughts on where oil is going to go and how that's going to affect what happens in Australian oil and gas investment that hasn't already happened in general terms.
Okay, that's no problem. Now, we've never owned Santos or Woodside because the economics of those businesses simply don't stack up. We don't own BHP either. If you have a look at BHP's profit, for example, in 2006, it was about $14 billion. If you have a look at their profit in 2014, it was about $14 billion. So their profit over 10 years or thereabouts, roughly, hasn't grown. Or 8 years, hasn't actually grown. But in that time, they've got vastly more equity capital from retained profits, and they've got vastly more debt. In fact, in 2006 or 2007, they had, if my numbers are correct in my mind, my memory, they had about $12 billion of debt. They've now got about $36 billion of debt. Now, Tony, if I lent you more money, or I gave you more equity capital, you could put that in a bank and you would earn more interest. Your profits, if you like, and your revenue would go up. But over that period of time, it hasn't. For these companies, it doesn't. So it's very, very difficult for me to justify buying those types of businesses when they're forced to take very large amounts of capital and generate not much in them other than volume growth. But when prices for commodities drop, they don't get a lot out of it. Now, back to the question about oil, where do I think the oil price is going to go? I think in our lifetime, Tony, we'll see oil prices much, much higher than where they are today. As oil reserves deplete, that will happen. I don't have any doubt about that. And I don't think batteries, by the way, are the solution either. I think there's an environmental disaster waiting for us if we go down the rechargeable battery path for everything. Having said all of that, at the moment, the oil price is low because of a battle between OPEC and the United States. The shale reserve profile, the production profile for shale oil is very, very steep for a short period of time, and a very steep decline and a very long tail. So this is a game of cat and mouse that's being played at the moment to see who blinks first. And I think OPEC is doing the right thing for themselves, not necessarily for the world, because if the oil price is forced down for a longer period of time, people might be tricked to making investments based on that lower oil price, and eventually we'll see oil much, much higher and those businesses will go broke.
So you believe long-term oil will be on the rise, but short-term perhaps not?
Well, nobody predicted this fall. I didn't predict it. And now we're listening to a whole bunch of people tell us where it's going to go, and those same people didn't predict where it is today. I do believe in the long run it will be much, much higher. I just can't tell you when that's going to happen.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Dan, you're a little bit concerned about the free trade agreement and the impact of overseas labour.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of I'm not a big fan of free trade agreements, mate. I think there's all smoke and mirrors. But if the opposition are as clever as what they think they are, why didn't they make more of a big deal about the fact that what you just said about the $2 drop in the price of iron ore wiping out the free trade agreement with China? And also, not only that, you don't need a free trade agreement to stop the labour market. It's already happening.
Yeah, you're exactly right. You're absolutely correct. Someone told me today the free trade FTA stood for freeway to acquisition rather than free trade agreement, and I don't dispute that. I think you're absolutely right. I was looking online today at the laws around whether or not you could take board and food from people's minimum wage. And so Andrew Robb has said that if foreign workers do come and work in these businesses in Australia, they'll be under Australian agreements. He won't allow Australia's labour policies to be undermined by foreign workers. But if they're paid $16.50 or $16.85 an hour and the employer takes food and board off that, they could be paid as little as $10 an hour or $5 an hour and still be satisfying the requirements to work under our present agreements. So it is a major, major problem. And we're being cast aside. So I agree with your sentiments.
Roger, thanks so much for being there. Always good to catch up with your perspectives and have a great Christmas and New Year.
Hopefully catch you up.
In 2015.
I look forward to seeing you then.
There he is, Roger Montgomery from Montgomery Investment Management tonight.